And now, from the world's leading maritime and offshore news website, gcaptain.com, comes the talk show for maritime professionals and enthusiasts, bringing you the latest news, discussion, and interviews with the industry's movers and shakers. This is GCaptain Radio with your hosts, Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad.
Hello and welcome to GCaptain Radio. My name is Jeff Eccles. I have in the studio with me Captain John Conrad. We are your hosts. Welcome, John. How are you today?
I'm doing great today. Excited to start this radio show.
So we are just kicking this off. This is going to be the new radio show, GCaptain Radio. Tell me what motivated you to get a weekly radio show going on your very popular site, gcaptain.com.
Well, we did a radio show a few years ago, and because I was traveling and still working on the ship, it became logistically difficult, but it was really popular feature. Everyone loved it. And we have so many stories in the week now, publishing 10, 12 stories a day. We really wanted to highlight what are the best stories? What are the ones that readers are really interested in?
Plus, I think there's something to be said for just talking about these things. We can write about the stories. You have some wonderful writers on the website. But talking about it and allowing us to ask some questions and get some back and forth, I think really fleshes out these stories. So let's talk about what's been going on over the last couple of weeks. And listeners, what we'll do is hit on the most current stories that are on the blog, as well as other current events that are going on in the maritime and offshore industry. So John, a few weeks back, you had the opportunity to travel over to South Korea. So tell me about that trip.
Maersk invited just a half dozen journalists to go see the world's largest ship in South Korea. It's being built at DSME Industries, and it's a 400-meter container ship built by Maersk that's going to be able to hold 18,000 containers, Jeff.
Wow. So 400 meters about in feet, because I'm your typical American, so I need a little help with my meters.
1,300 feet approximately.
Wow. Now that is a big boat. What kind of draft does something like that have on it, John?
This ship is going to have a draft of 14.5 meters, which is 48 feet. And the size of the vessel is going to be too big for the Panama Canal, but the real restricting thing in the Suez Canal is the draft of the vessel. And this ship is well within the range of the Suez Canal requirements, so that's going to be its passage from China to Europe through the Suez Canal.
A 48-foot draft.
Correct.
Wow. Now, I know a little bit about boats, not as much as you know about boats and shipping. Our listeners will find out that I had a short stint as a merchant mariner. I was an esteemed ordinary seaman on 285-foot research vessels about 25, 30 years ago. We did some contract work for the Navy. So one of these days, we'll tell some stories with regard to my experience.
It's a steep learning curve in the winter North Atlantic where Jeff sailed. So I've
shared with you that I've gone the North Atlantic, across the North Atlantic in the wintertime, and that was an experience that is not to be forgotten. But I do know this, a 48-foot draft on a boat is big, correct?
Correct. It's considerable size. This is the sailing draft. Right now, as it's sitting in shipyard, it doesn't have any cargo. It doesn't have any fuel or ballast. So it's sitting high in the water, but when it's all loaded down, it's going to be 48 feet into the water, which makes it too deep to go into most ports. There are only 13 ports in the world this ship is planning on going to, and none of them are in the United States.
That is amazing. So in terms of crew on a boat like this, how many crew members would it take to run a vessel of this size?
The minimum safe manning certificate is for 14 people, so legally they have to have at least 14. Maersk plans on putting 20 to 25 people on board the ship, but this ship is almost 200 feet longer than our biggest aircraft carrier, which holds 5 to 6,000 people, so it's a big difference.
It's amazing, and I would imagine that a lot of that is due to technology. In other words, a minimum crew of 14 people manning a 1,300-foot vessel is due to the fact that technology allows that. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, this is actually a very low-tech vessel when you compare it to a drill ship or an FPSO. There isn't very much technology involved. I also asked Maersk about redundancy. It has two engines, so if one engine goes down, they can run off the second engine, but very little else about the ship is redundant. The reason they can get away with so few people is because the cargo is self-contained. The crew doesn't have to monitor the cargo. They don't have to check on it. This ship is using new securing methods that are going to be the first in MERS fleet. And the quality of construction in South Korea means that the maintenance costs are and the periodic maintenance are fairly low.
Very interesting. So, and you mentioned the redundancy of the two engines. Are both engines running concurrently, or is it literally a backup engine that doesn't run and that engine runs only when needed?
Oh, it's two engines, two shafts, and two propellers, and they're running all the time. MERS said they're doing this. The predecessor to this was the Emma Maersk, and that is a slightly smaller ship, MERS's last generation. That had the largest engine in the world. But they found that wasn't as efficient as having two smaller engines. So even the engines on the ship aren't very impressive. What is impressive is just the sheer size.
So I understand the redundancy issue now. And do you know about the size of those engines? I mean, they must be absolutely huge as far as horsepower or size. Again, I don't know a lot of the specifics about these large engines, but I could imagine they must be the size of a house.
Well, the one on the Emma Maersk was the size of the house, the largest in the world, most powerful in the world. These two engines are more powerful than that one. As far as specific horsepower, I'm not certain. But in the show notes, we're going to have a link to photos of the engine room. We were able to take photos on the tour, and we got some good pictures of it.
Oh, wonderful. So if somebody wants to see those pictures, of course, they can go on gcaptain.com and check out those pictures.
Absolutely.
Very nice. So how long were you over in South Korea, John?
It's over there for 3 days. One day we had a tour. They brought some of the designers and executives from Denmark to South Korea to give us a lecture on Monday. And then Tuesday we went and toured the vessel, toured the shipyard, and talked with the management team, the actual naval architects and engineers working for Maersk and DSME at the shipyard.
And what did you find to be some of the most interesting parts about that process that you went through?
Well, it's just a amazing process. This ship is built in sections. There are 31 sections that are built. 40% of it was built in Korea, so they built these huge sections in Korea, put them on a heavy lift ship, built in China, sailed them for 7 days, and brought them to Korea. That was 40% of the ship. The rest of the ship was built right there in the shipyard using some of the largest cranes in the world, some of the largest, most advanced equipment. And then these huge scissor lift barge cranes lift these giant sections called mega blocks and drop them in the dry dock. And they have to be positioned with only 4 millimeter tolerance. And a barge is doing this just by, the barge sets out 6 to 8 anchors, and just on a radio, the guy goes 1 millimeter to the left, and they pull in the anchor on inside of the barge and just slowly scoot it 1 millimeter over. It's amazing.
That would be interesting to watch. Some very precise work there. And culturally, how were you treated by the South Koreans when you were over there? Did you have any interesting interactions or stories that you can share with the folks there?
Well, I lived in Korea on a rotational schedule, so month on, month off in 2009, and I absolutely loved it. This place is probably the coolest place on Earth. They're building the biggest machines, moving machines known to man, and the Koreans are super efficient. I wrote about it a few chapters in my book, but you know, the most amazing thing is just in the morning, 40,000 people work at this one shipyard, and they had to stagger them. So they started arriving at 7 and then to 9 o'clock, but 40,000 people coming in on bicycles is just an amazing sight.
Wow, I bet. And how were you invited to go on this little, what type of trip was it that you were able to view the ship this way?
Maersk invited maritime journalists. They want they want to let the maritime community know more about the ship for two reasons. There's a marketing reason. They're trying to get suppliers to put their containers on Maersk ships. But the head of marketing at Maersk, Michael Stogard, actually told me their primary reason why they do so much marketing and why they advertise and why they invite journalists to understand these ships and write articles about them is to really attract the best and the brightest in the industry. They want the best naval arcs. They want the best captains. They want, and they realize if we write stories about it and talk about it here on the radio show, that some of the best and brightest are our listeners, and they're going to apply to Maersk, and it's a win-win situation for them.
So let's talk a little bit of subjectivity here and just explore things a little bit. There's the old saying that bigger is better, or that size matters. Do you think in this instance, this ship being so large is a benefit? And do you see this as a future trend in the maritime industry?
It's certainly the buzzword right now. The shipping industry is so volatile. When Maersk ordered these a few years ago, the original price tag was $190 million. Now, China Shipping just ordered similar ships for $140, $150 million range because the shipping market has gone down. The container rates are at a historic low. But, China's developing, and this environmental reason, the main reason for this ship is the price of oil is so high. If you can put more containers on one ship, you're saving in fuel costs. And that's the real bottom line. So as long as we have a restricted supply in oil and prices stay high, we're going to see larger ships and more environmentally friendly engines and technologies like the waste heat recovery system they're using on these engines so that they can take some of the heat that would go out the smokestack and use that for propulsion. So I think it is a trend that's going to continue. And of course, this is not going to be the largest ship for long. Samsung, on the other side of the island, is building the Shell Prelude. It's a LNG FPSO. It's going to be 88 meters larger than this. So that's 288 feet, so considerably bigger in size.
Wow. And I would imagine a ship like that is probably made for a specific run or specific ports?
The LNG FPSO isn't going to move at all. Right in the Gulf of Mexico, when we drill an oil well, we have extensive pipelines that bring that oil and natural gas to refineries. But when you start drilling in places like Nigeria and Brazil, which are newer to the, don't have that extensive pipeline infrastructure already in place, they bring that oil up and the FPSO sits right over the oil well. And then the lightering tankers will come next to it and offload that oil and transport that oil on a smaller tanker to a refinery.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I'm enjoying this radio show already, John, because I'm learning those kind of things from you. Excellent. So what else would you like to tell us about the biggest ship in the world and your trip over to South Korea before we move on to other topics?
Not too much. This is an evolving story. The ship's going to be launched next year, and we're going to continue to talk about this, so stay tuned.
Okay. In other news, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen the cruise ship industry continue to have their challenges. The latest we've seen is a fire on the, on Royal Caribbean's liner, the Grandeur of the Seas. So what can you tell me about that?
We don't know too much about this fire right now. It just happened on Monday. What we do know is at 02:50 in the morning on Monday, there was a fire in the aft mooring station of the ship. This is where they bring the lines and to dock the vessel. We don't know what started the fire, but it quickly grew, quickly expanded, and did significant damage to that deck and the deck above it, and took the crew 2 hours to extinguish it and get under control.
It seems odd, and you have some pictures on the website. It seems an odd place for a picture or for a fire to break out, doesn't it?
It sure does. There isn't very much in a mooring station that right. can catch fire. The winches may be hydraulic. There could be some hydraulic oil that would cause a Class B fire. There's the mooring lines, potentially. You would think they would store them away. But because their itinerary is so tight and they visit so many ports, they may leave them there. So there is some Class B material and some Class A material that's stored there. How it got caught, could someone have flicked a cigarette into the mooring lines, or where was there a hydraulic leak that caught? We don't know.
Yeah, and I was thinking along the same lines. My and this is purely speculation, but my speculation would be that it's something to do with somebody screwing up, something man-made as opposed to a mechanical malfunction. It just seems like such an odd place to have a fire back there. And in general, fires out at sea on cruise ships seem to be rather limited. What we've heard about in the news over the last several years have been more things going on in the galley and food department with people getting sick. But we don't really hear too much about fire out at sea on cruise ships, do we?
There have been a number of fires. The Carnival cruise ship lost its engine room. The cruise ship fires are fairly limited in scope. And I think the reason for that is because the crew levels. This Granger of the Sea had 796 crew members. They all have basic understanding of, you know, what is done in emergencies. They drill significantly, but a number of those crew have actual firefighting training. And to fight a crew, and the problem that ships that only have 20 people or less on it have with fire is you really need a lot of manpower. You got to close the door, secure the hatches, secure the ventilation. You got to set out the hoses. You got to bring equipment to the fire scene. You got to man boundary areas. But when you have 796 crew members on board, you have that manpower to get things done quickly. And I think that's why they're able to contain the fires on these ships.
Do you see from your vantage point and the experience that you've had in the industry what some of the challenges are that face the cruise line industry? I know they've been getting a lot of negative press over the last year or two, but what do you see from your purview the challenges for that industry?
Well, the industry just keeps on going. You know, all of these incidents, and the biggest was Carnival, these passengers were subjected to two and a half days without power. Their toilets didn't work. They were stuck out there, and the whole ship had to be towed in. Now, the experts I've talked to in the industry said this is really, we've seen fires before. We've even seen Costa Concordia, the entire ship, hit rocks, capsized, and people died. That didn't really affect ticket sales too much, according to the experts. The industry lowered rates for a while, and whenever the ticket prices went down, despite whatever danger there seemed to be present, you know, people saw, wow, it's 20% less expensive than it was last year, and the bookings went up. The difference here with that Carnival incident where they lost power, their sanitation system worked, is people can't relate to it. You know, they can't picture themselves on a ship and seeing the whole thing hit rocks and capsize and death. It's something the brain's not familiar with, but we're all familiar with backed up toilets. And because that image is so much easier for the passengers to comprehend, ticket sales, because of that, have gone down. And Carnival, as a result, is in some financial trouble. So these fires, these big incidents like the Costa Concordia don't seem to affect ticket sales, but the small things, the passengers' comfort, really do. But the big trend in the industry is just to get bigger and bigger, and you know, that's what we're looking at.
That's a very interesting observation, John. So we can run a cruise ship up onto a rocky shoal and sell more tickets in the ensuing months by dropping the price a little bit, but if we get backed up heads, then it's going to scare some people off. And it really does make sense when you shine a light on it like that. Very interesting observation. So let's move on as well to another topic, something that you've got on the website here. And the title, I found the title interesting, Bulk Trade-Off, Blood for Money in Indonesia. So what's going on there in that story?
This is a fascinating story that no one else is reporting about. It's really a G-Captain exclusive. There have been some The Economist did a great story on it, but we have Mario Vitone. He's one of our best authors. He was a Coast Guard inspector and a rescue swimmer before then. He's a real expert at figuring out, you know, what's going on in these maritime incidents. And in this particular one, what Mario has uncovered is in Indonesia in the last 14 months, there have been 16 deaths as a result of a number of these ships sinking. And it's all this nickel iron ore. So this is really fine material. These are bulkers. And it's loaded on these vessels in these small ports in Indonesia that there's not much technology or advancement here. And this cargo isn't even covered prior to loading. And there's no way for them. There are ways, but the companies are not investing in testing this to see how much moisture and this human environment and if any rain got into this cargo. Because what's happening is they're loading this cargo, and if it, this nickel iron ore, if it gets wet, it becomes basically a liquid. And as we know, with free surface effect on ships, once you have liquid in these wide tanks that go the whole width of the ship gets very unstable, and they're capsizing in a just incredible rate.
Wow. So that's something that needs to be looked at on an international scale like that. What entity or body would oversee something like that?
Well, this is a problem that's really specific to Indonesia. The majority of these ports, the mining operations, are in Indonesia. So the responsibility here is really in Indonesia. Three of the ships that capsized were Panama flag. So Panama is also responsible. They should do investigation, and we should have some reports on their investigation report soon. And the IMO is also concerned. But this is really out of sight. You know, this is, there are no journalists, reporters in these ports. They're small ports. These crews, most of them don't speak English. So this news hasn't filtered out to the major bodies very well. Intercargo, the president of Intercargo talked about it at a recent conference and is concerned. But there hasn't been much attention, and hopefully with Mario's article here, we can start to get some action here.
I agree, and of course, keeping our mariners safe out at sea is paramount, and this does seem to have flown under the radar, so a fantastic story that you have on gcaptain.com there. Well, we are just about out of time today. We've got so much to cover, so many interesting things. Listeners, remember that we are now producing GCaptain Radio on a weekly basis. So be sure to tune in next week to find out more about what's been going on. John, because we're toward the end of the show here, when we just have a couple of minutes left and you've started up the radio show again, I'm going to take the opportunity just to ask a little bit about your background. Over the next several months, the listeners will be able to get to know you as well as myself a little bit better. So in terms of what got you into the industry, you're a sea captain. Why don't you just share with us briefly a little bit about your background?
Sure. My love of the sea really started fishing with my grandpa off the south shore of Long Island, and spent a lot of time on his boat and a lot of time sailing in the Long Island Sound, and grew up near the water. And then I went to SUNY Maritime College in the Bronx, and I was opened up to this world of shipping, and two things really attracted me. It was, you know, these are the largest objects in the world ever built that a person can drive, and I wanted to drive them, and quite frankly, the money was really good. They just did a report, I think it was USA Today, saying that SUNY Maritime College, out of every college in the nation, is the top five in terms of ROI. So the amount of tuition versus before that you have to put in versus the amount of money you get afterwards. So difficult school, huge attrition rate, but you know, going on the training ship every summer, we take the entire school, packs up and goes to Europe. You cross the Atlantic for the first time, and you really fall in love with it.
Mm-hmm. So King's Point is back there. Maybe we can get a little rivalry going here. Are you familiar with King's Point?
Yeah, they are just across the East River. You can wave at them at the end of classes if you wanted to.
If you were so inclined. So here we go. How did you guys compare to King's Point?
Well, King's Point is really a different ballgame. Federal Maritime Academy, their professors are tenured, they're paid well. They steal a lot of the professors from SUNY Maritime. Mm. But it's really a different operating environment. They do cadet shipping. We do, at Schuyler, we did went on a training ship. At King's Point, you have an obligation to go in the Merchant Marine Reserves. At Schuyler, you could be a civilian. You didn't have the obligation when you go out. So they both train for ships, but a larger majority of the King's Point graduates, now they have service requirements. Some of them have to serve on ships or shipyards. But back when I went, the large majority went and they got Wall Street jobs. They worked for big companies. While Schuyler really seemed to be concentrated more on, a lot more of their graduates were actually out on vessels, which is what attracted me.
Interesting. Now, I sailed, as I mentioned earlier in the show, as a lowly ordinary seaman. That was back in 1987 and 1988. And I sailed with some officers that were from King's Point. That's about the extent of my knowledge of King's Point, as well as a few officers from California Maritime Academy, CMA. And back then, CMA wasn't part of the university system in California, which I understand it is now. So we'll be sharing some more old sailor stories here as we go along. John, it's been a pleasure doing the show with you today. Any final thoughts this week for our listeners?
No, stay tuned. These are just the top stories that have been on GCaptain. But we noticed a lot of people just go to the homepage, and there's so many great stories buried in the back pages of GCaptain. So use that search feature, scroll back to page 2 and 3. And you'll really uncover some hidden gems. And I want to thank you, Jeff, for really putting this together. Jeff, you may not know, has a lot of local radio experience in addition to his background in the Merchant Marine. So I wanted to thank you for helping to put this together.
It's my pleasure. I always enjoy doing radio, and especially on such an interesting topic as the maritime and offshore industry. Listeners, thank you for tuning in this week. Be sure to tune in again next week. We are going to keep you informed about all the happenings in the maritime and offshore industry. Signing off now is Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad for GCaptain Radio.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest in maritime and offshore news. GCaptain Radio is a production of GCaptain.com and is recorded weekly in Morro Bay, California. For more information or to be a guest on the show, visit GCaptain.com.